Hello and welcome to another episode of the Ice Cream for Everyone podcast. This is Willem Vanderhorst, your host for the show. Okay, we have another episode coming out. I am running a little bit behind with my editing. Fortunately, that's because I have a little bit of more work going on. I'm still available. I still have a little bit of time for extra projects, in which case, if ever that happens, I might have to slow down the editing schedule even more. But I'm still having conversations with guests and fantastic conversations too, so I'm just catching up a little bit. I thought for a little bit I'd be able to do prepare, publish, edit one more than one episode a week, but the last couple of episodes and this one I'm just took a little bit longer than I thought to edit. In this particular case, a fantastic conversation with Jim Pietrzynski. He is the partner and chief strategy officer at the branding agency called SoulSight in Chicago. So Chicago-based, they've worked a lot with Fortune 100 and, you know, extremely large brands. They've worked on several beer branding design with MillerCoors. For example, they just recently rebranded Sol, the Mexican beer. They worked on Blue Moon. They worked on Henry's Hard Soda. They worked on a lot of different large brands and as well as smaller local brands. But MillerCoors is what comes to mind. But they've worked on Kraft and Heinz. They worked with PepsiCo on some of their brands. So a lot of mass market, we talk about consumer packaged goods, so CPG brands, or FMCG if you're listening from the other side of the Atlantic, fast-moving consumer goods. Or if you don't work in this industry, basically a lot of the stuff that you can either find in the supermarket, or we also talked during the episode about what's going on a little bit, what kind of trends Jim is seeing in clients being more interested in recyclable, reusable, or more quote-unquote environmentally friendly or environmentally responsible materials for brands, for packaging, for things like that. So what's going on in that area, as well as newer challenger brands that tend to be selling directly online and that you receive in the mail. So we talk about those as well. So a fantastic conversation about Jim and SoulSight's vision of branding and design, how Jim got into it, how he started designing for brands. And so some great stories there. What's Soulful brand design? What goes into it? How is it different or the same from what a lot of my experience on the branding, not so much branding, but on marketing and media and advertising side. So I've had the chance to work on brand strategy from that side of things, which often tends to be separate if ever you don't know. And sometimes it's the same. I've also had the chance of working on branding projects, but most of it is towards advertising and marketing communications, whereas Jim is more towards the brand itself. So that it tends to be more often the logo, the packaging, and where it's situated inside of the supermarket. Even though I will look at, you know, what's going on in the supermarket as well, like where, which aisle it's in. So that's something that we would both look at. And we talk about going out there and being able to see, you know, and interact with all the people that are buying these brands and what they're dealing with in their day-to-day life, and as well as how they show up in brands, where, you know, in a supermarket, in Walmart, whatever the case may be. So, yeah, let's see. Am I missing anything else? No, I hope you enjoy. It was a fantastic conversation. I really enjoyed meeting Jim. I was talking about the editing delays just because we met in person, and it's fantastic to meet in person. So the sound quality is very different. It took me a little bit longer to edit, mostly because I'm an amateur and I'm learning this stuff as I go. And the material I have a very nifty, very cool digital recorder, but I've attached a couple of lapel mics because I thought that would be better when I bought them. But it turned out after the fact that actually that's not the best thing to record. And because, well, I don't know if you want a crash course in audio stuff, but a lapel mic tends to be omnidirectional. So it's recording all around it. So both mics record both voices, which is not what it tends to be either when I'm recording online, or had I thought to look really in advance properly and bought directional mics so that, you know, we wouldn't have so much us talking over each other. So I had to clean. Anyway, it took me longer to clean the audio tracks. It works fine. There's a couple of bits where we're just, you know, I'm finishing a question, he's starting an answer sort of thing, and it resonates. There's a tiny bit of echo because there's both, or like a tiny bit stereo, which by the time I finish this, I don't think it's going to be much of an issue unless you really have a very fine ear. Anyway, a bit of the usual house cleaning and promo. So springtime in Chicago. If you haven't, please subscribe to the podcast. I have no idea how that's related to springtime, but springtime just happens to be the time of year and what's going on right now as I'm looking out of my window. But the other thing that would be amazing, not only it would be amazing if you subscribe, it would be fantastic if you post a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcasting app, or you open iTunes and type in Ice Cream for Everyone and please give it 5 stars and write a note. It really is hugely encouraging when you do. It helps other people find the podcast. What other, also helps other people find the podcast is if you post the episode on Twitter, you share it with your friends on Facebook or via email. If you enjoyed it, you know, just tell more people about the podcast. And as I'm noting, there's increasing amounts of, well, I guess competition for people's attention, which is what we all deal with in marketing and advertising and whatever activity we get up to, including listening to this particular podcast. So I appreciate you taking the time to listen is another thing. And if you appreciate and enjoy it, please give me a shout, whether it's that kind of rating is awesome, or send me a tweet that says, I'm at Willem van der Horst, or I see Willem, letters I, letter C, Willem, W-I-L-L-E-M. You can find all the other episodes. You can find out more about my services and brand and marketing strategy. If you need some advice for your brand, your project, don't hesitate getting in touch. I'm always happy to chat. You can send me an email at willem@icecreamforeveryone.net. So again, W-I-L-L-E-M @icecreamforeveryone.net. Everything spelled out. And on the website, you got it. It's icecreamforeveryone.net. You can also subscribe to the weekly email newsletter, the Ice Cream Sunday newsletter, in which I send usually what's going on with news for myself and Ice Cream for Everyone, new research and findings in terms of my area of playful strategy. I'm behind on editing. I'm certainly behind on the articles I've been writing and preparing. And I also post a couple of links that I call the weekly combo. So it's like 2 or 3 links that I find interesting together. So it's not overwhelming in terms of like what there is to read in it. So, but that's about it. Without further ado, here's the conversation I had with Jim from SoulSight.
Thank you.
So we are at the SoulSight office, and this is your house. Thank you very much for having me. We were just talking before we hit the record button about the fact that I've done interviews in person. I really, really enjoy them, but sometimes it's a bit complicated from an organization perspective, and you suggested, like, why don't we do it here? Thank you so much for that. I really appreciate it. It's cool.
You're welcome. I always would rather meet people in person than over the phone or via email.
Yeah.
Get to know the face and have some body language and some dialogue to be able to understand and learn more about you also.
Yeah, sure, for sure. So before we go, there was, I looked through your Twitter and a few other things before we prepared the conversation, to prepare for this conversation. And I saw, and I believe you're from Iowa, and I saw that there are big floods and people are dealing with a number of stuff. I thought I'd check with you if that's anybody you know impacted or...
Spent some time in Iowa. Most of my family that's in Iowa are my in-laws. So my wife was born and raised in Iowa. I went to school in Iowa. And ironically, I have a twin brother who lives in Iowa also. Fortunately, they're east of where all of that flooding is happening. Okay. But it's been great to see the support for the state and where all the flooding is happening in that part of of our country.
Yes, absolutely.
So fortunately, everyone's safe. Thanks for asking.
Good. So you did you grow up in Iowa then? Or?
I did not, actually.
Okay. I thought you had for some reason.
No, I did not grow up in Iowa, although I would say that I probably have spent a good portion of my life driving back and forth in Iowa, visiting family there. And I do, Iowa, it has a special place in my heart just in terms of the people that are in Iowa and the generosity and sincerity of the hardworking people that I have met in my years of travels throughout the entire state. But I was born and raised in the Chicagoland area. My family is originally from the Pilsen neighborhood, if you're familiar with Chicago. It is a very Mexican community now, but at the time my great-grandparents settled in Chicago, they had a house in Pilsen, and it was in the family for 2 generations or 3 generations, and eventually my family moved to my mom and dad moved to the suburbs. And then my grandmother moving with us. It was a very much a generational household of living with grandparents and taking care of grandparents and just the nature of the culture. And so I'm actually 3rd generation Polish American, don't speak any Polish except for a few curse words, and the first of our family to go to college. So it's interesting. I don't think that my parents married or out of the church or the neighborhood for a number of generations, and that was just out of the segregation that was in Chicago at the time and where that went. So my first trip out of Chicago beyond vacation to live somewhere else was going to college at the University of in Iowa, at the Iowa State University.
By the way, how do you pronounce your name? Just to make sure I don't butcher it when I introduce you. I usually prepare a separate intro.
We will say Petrzynski in English.
Petrzynski.
In Polish, if you know any Polish, we say Pietrzynski.
Pietrzynski.
But Petrzynski is great.
Okay, good. Thank you. So just a bit of an intro on, we're at SoulSight. This is the agency where we are, branding agency. But like, can you give us a bit of a intro about...
Sure. So I've been with
the agency quickly.
Sure. I've been with SoulSight since its inception. We started 22 years ago, which doesn't seem possible. And three of us started to work together to build this agency, and with the notion to do something different with branding and with really starting with packaged goods and packaged consumer goods. And those packaged consumer goods really originated with how we think about the artifacts in which the brands are relatable to the humans that consume them, or the consumers that we talk about. I know consumer is a bad word and you're going to hear me use it, but I don't have another word yet to really describe those individuals that buy brands. And I had an opportunity I was working for a larger branding organization to move to work with a startup company. And we really started to specialize in more small, mid-level entrepreneurial type businesses where innovation and brand building was needed. Growing the business all the way to the iconic and Fortune 100 and 500 brands that we work with today, and using a lot of the similar principles that we did with startups, with large scale brands, and watching that business grow, eventually meeting my partners in business, Adam Ferguson and George Argyros, to begin to build the 60 person agency that we have today. So we do a lot of work in what I would say is we call iconic branding, and that iconic branding is the center of how we think about brands in the marketplace, and that can extend to many different things. If you think about a brand, I like to use the analogy of a bicycle wheel. So the brand sits at the center of that wheel, and every spoke is a different activation for that supports that brand, and we work on many of those spokes. One that we don't do a lot of, but we're looking to move into, is some more media or social or digital activation, but we've pretty much touched every single aspect of that spoke in every category of the store and market and in a lot of different services also. So the experiences ranges per month. That's what's exciting about what we do, is that every month is a different, something new and different to learn about. Every year we're moving in a different direction and constantly evolving. SoulSight is founded in this notion of creating a safe place to create and inspire each other and inspire the work and inspire brands. I would say this idea of incubation and incubating ideas and letting those grow into what we call our babies when they get released into the marketplace is a really exciting, there's an exciting energy to all of that. I think that when we really were thinking about SoulSight and what we could be different, the transparency with creativity, respect, and honesty was important. And we often talk a lot about conflict. And conflict and tensions are not necessarily bad things, but there's healthy conflict that creates amazing opportunities, especially with creativity and branding. And one of our core drivers in how we talk about brands is that there has to be a conflict within the brand itself, that are two positive forces working together. And how do we think about brands in that way? But then also, how do we think about that in our culture and environment that we have here at SoulSight? So we want healthy, trusted relationships that then can create these dynamic forces that come together to create inspiration with new ideas. So it's really rooted in a lot of storytelling and how that comes to life. But really, how do those tensions really build something bigger than one person can create on their own or an individual on their own, but the collaboration of us working together?
Fantastic. Thank you. So we're going to dig into a few different areas of what we were just mentioning, but I thought we'd start, and you talked about the fact that you began SoulSight in packaging, and that's an interest of yours. And I noticed, and I saw that you contributed or co-authored a book called The Big Book of Packaging.
Yes.
And I was lucky enough to find a couple of free pages because I didn't have all that much time to prepare. But there was a bit in your intro about the fact that your mother used to say that you learned to draw before you learned to walk or read.
Yeah, that's a true story. It's funny to bring that up, but it is. I was fascinated by cereal boxes when I was a kid. And I think everyone kind of is in some way. It's like it sits on the table. You look at the back panel, you look at the front panel, you look at the branding. I remember distinctly drawing, I don't know if this what this says about, my diet as a child, but looking at Frosted Flakes and Tony the Tiger and drawing Tony the Tiger over and over again and showing the pictures as a child does to their parents, proud of what they've accomplished. And my mom not believing that I actually drew it, that I traced it. So some of those, it just naturally came to me to be able to think about characters and brands and what that means for the brands. But I was fascinated by these branded characters. I couldn't read the box, but I could associate with the image on the package. And I was lucky enough to have a grandfather who was also, more of a packaging engineer than he was actually a artist, but he could draw, his drawing abilities were amazing. And he smoked probably a pack a day. He would sit at the kitchen table and listen to AM radio. And I would sit with him and we would draw together. And he would show me how to draw elephants. And we were drawing elephants. I think this is in the intro. We would draw elephants over and over and over again. And they're actually a hard animal to draw without any recognition of looking at it, just because of scale and perspective and all different types of elephants. And I don't know what his fascination was with elephants, but it's interesting if you think about the symbology. And, he died when I was fairly young. So he died when I was only 13 or 14 years old, but I had a really strong relationship with him growing up because of the time I spent with him drawing. And I can only imagine in my adulthood, I ask myself all the time, why elephants? And you think about the symbolism that elephants have in culture and the symbolism that that elephants have in just in general in terms of the brilliance that they have in terms of they're supposed to be one of the smartest animals. They mourn their losses. They're a communal animal, but the way they're even designed to live in conditions that an animal that large should not survive in is super interesting. So the power that comes from learning about an elephant, but also this notion of just the idea of this creative animal, that if there was some deeper meaning behind why an elephant, I can't tell you. It just was something that came from my grandfather and maybe some bit of knowledge or history. So again, as I'm older, I'm always fascinated by elephants. And I don't know, it's a Polish tradition to have an elephant in your home too.
Is it really?
And it has to face the door, and the trunk has to be facing up. There's all different kinds of symbolism to them. My Polish family. So I think it's a relic that we often use as a sign of fortune and good luck. So
did you have a chance to go see any in Asia or Africa?
I have not. No? I have not, unfortunately. My closest connection to an elephant is, unfortunately, zoos or circuses, which thank God they're no longer in circuses, but they are pretty amazing creatures.
They are. And I don't know much about them, to be honest, but I didn't know that there were Polish traditions about them, and certainly in India.
Yes.
And I was lucky to visit India during the Ganesh festival, which was really, really fascinating to see everybody it's like gigantic. It's one of the four big religious parties/ceremonies/festivals. I think festivals is the
yes.
right word. Like everybody goes, I don't know if you know, but there's about 5-6 weeks and there's neighborhoods or communities that have their own Ganesh shrine, and they bring offerings every week or every day or every night. And then at the end on the day, everybody brings their shrine to the body of water that is the closest, whichever is going to be a river, if there's a big river around the city, and they dump the Ganesh inside.
Very interesting.
And it represents something that I can't remember right now. I was not prepared to talk about elephants.
That's okay.
But that's cool. So you started out with designing and drawing, and then the drawing just kept, you kept working on it after working with
Interestingly enough, I always felt, you always feel like is there something I'm good at? What am I good at? And I'm like, I love to draw. I continue to draw throughout my childhood and through the high school and teenage years. And I didn't really understand what graphic design was until I was probably about 19 years old. It was, 1991. And moving into college, looking at opportunities for what am I going to do with my life? And I knew I wanted to do something with art. I knew I wanted to do something with art and design.
Sorry, do you mean, what style of stuff were you drawing at the time? Was it a range or?
Range of art, so fine arts.
Okay.
You know, so I was really interested in fine arts, and I wasn't interested into graphic design until my scene.
So not so much comics, for example, or cartoonists.
Read a lot of Marvel.
Okay.
Yeah, so like a lot of loved graphic novels, you know, loved just learning and watching how the stories developed almost through not having to read it at times.
I think you'd enjoy. So just before we hit the record button, we were just talking about Neil Gaiman and the Sandman series that he's very famous for. You'd enjoy. I think it's really awesome.
Great.
Sorry, just
segue. So I had the opportunity to look at different colleges and apply to different universities and started to learn about this Bachelor of Fine Arts that I could achieve with graphic design, and not knowing anything about graphic design, not really using a computer much, but my hand skills to create, you know, anything that was remotely artistic. And moving into looking at the universities and the different options, was fascinated by graphic design and what that meant, because the word is kind of loaded, right? It can mean a lot of different things depending on what you do. You can become, even from programming to branding and print production and all the different ways that can take you, just like an engineer can mean many different things, graphic design can mean very many different things for different people. And so I was fascinated by that, by graphic design, and really got in college more interested in the four-dimensional and three-dimensional form of things. So working with a professor on creating packaging forms and structures, and working in sculpture and understanding, thinking about sculpture and what that meant. And I don't think I have the math skills to be an industrial designer, but I've always been very fond of strong industrial design and what that means in terms of really thinking about human needs. And I think some of that also coming from thinking about anthropology. So I also got really interested in cultural anthropology and understanding people and watching people and what they're doing and how they're responding to things. What are they wearing? Why do they choose certain brands to define who they are? What purpose does it mean? What does it mean about them? And just really trying to understand more about individuals and the choices they make, tied nicely with almost the design approach and solving human needs and what is it that people want and all these questions we ask ourselves about in marketing, and digging deeper and more than just the analytics of why, you know, we can do all these analytics and understand what's being pulled off the shelf, but the whole question of why, and this will be the why question will be something that will go on forever and ever, and we should always continue to ask the why questions. But really started to fascinate me to continue to grow and build, and something we bring to the SoulSight is really asking ourselves, you know, what's next, or why, where should we evolve, what should we do? That even in business, there's ways that the design approach can change in how we think about things.
Yeah, fantastic. Thank you. And so one of the areas I also talk about and look into in this podcast is around play and games. I was wondering, drawing was an important part of growing up. What kind of stuff did you do for play as a kid?
Play, wow. So I grew up I have a twin brother and a brother that's 15 months younger, and then a sister who's 4 years younger. And I would say we grew up in a household where creative play was really encouraged. So a lot of our play was outdoors. A lot of our play was in the neighborhood. It was less focused on probably specific games that we might play, but just fantasy play or frolicking in the woods, you know, getting in touch with more with nature. You know, I think that I have a strong connection to water and loving to swim and being in the outdoors. There wasn't, I would say that most of the play was, you know, made up fantasy play, like letting kids just be kids. So I was fortunate enough to have that type of environment where that was encouraged for us.
That's awesome. That kind of thing seems to have changed now, isn't it? I wonder, I don't know if you have children.
Interesting. I do have two children. I have a 14-year-old and 11-year-old, and they're both very much about being kids, which we let them be kids. But it's the time, I think, in today's world with everything they're involved with, at a certain age, childhood ends and activities begin, I say. You know, it's then the activities for parents also begin too. So finding the right time to have that downtime is really special, and making sure that, you know, being bored is not a bad thing.
Yes.
You know, being bored is actually a great thing. And sometimes when I hear my kids say, I'm bored, I'll say, great, go pick up a book. You know, great, go out and walk around the block. You know, like there are many different ways to fill our time. I think we fill because of technology, and we can't shy away from it because it's just here to stay, and things will constantly evolve and change. We're still adjusting. I think we're still catching up as human beings to how to keep. We want to keep ourselves occupied all the time. I ride the train to the city every day, and it's amazing to me how tied everyone is to
their phone screens, right?
Yeah, their electronic devices. Less people are reading books. Less people are engaged in conversation. And I spend a lot of time watching people and just how they're interacting with their phones or how they're choosing to connect with other people. And it's fascinating. You talk about gaming. How many adults are playing games while they're commuting?
Yeah, on their phones. And I mean, I'm quite opinionated about most of the games that people are playing right now that has become a gigantic industry. And they're not wrong or bad necessarily, but a lot of those games are designed with every implement from gambling. And they're games, but they're arguably given you just have to do one action and then wait, or you're encouraged to pay money. So there's not, in my opinion, there's a limited amount of enjoyment for the sake of what you're doing when you're playing the game, because it's always trying to get you to keep you to do another thing. And that's more like gambling. And I've not had a lot of conversations or research. I've read a couple of things about it. I want to do more on what's the distinction and what makes gambling versus gaming, because they're close cousins. They work together. I mean, gambling are considered games, but not all of them are. It's arguable how much pulling a slot machine tab is a game-ish. It is in terms of randomness, because randomness can be an element of a game. A lot of sociologists who've defined playing games and defined that as one particular area, but I would say it's not the one that I find the most interesting.
Sure.
And yet, and you're right, it's really fascinating to see the amount of people that are playing on their phones. Sometimes engaged, but sometimes kind of mindlessly.
Yes.
You know? And if you're engaged, I think it's great. And if you're doing it mindlessly, then maybe you could be doing something else. But it's fine to do it mindlessly. There's nothing wrong with it. But I don't know. I don't know. I'm ambivalent about it.
Sure. It is very interesting, though, just to look and watch what people are playing.
For sure.
Amazingly, Candy Crush is still pretty popular from what I can see on the train. Yeah.
Wow, fascinating. I thought everybody had moved to those. Not everybody, but just I know a lot of people played, what's it called? Clash of Clans or similar.
Yes.
Do you play games on your phone?
I don't. No.
What do you do commuting? So you look at people. I do that too.
So I'm a big Netflix junkie or Hulu, but I do watch a lot of Netflix or work on the train. So there's a lot of, or reading. So those are my choices for the most part. I should say actually sleep, read, Netflix.
Yeah.
Those are the things, or work. I mean, those are my.
Any shows or movies or things that you've watched on Netflix recently that you recommend?
I currently finished, there's a Formula One documentary that's on right now. It's fascinating about which I did not know much about, Formula One racing, and fascinated by, again, talk about branding, talk about marketing, and what that, I think it really came to life in the 60s and the 70s, and like what that's turned into from a global phenomenon, and the amount of athleticism involved in driving those cars, and the sense of just courage it takes to get behind the wheel of one of those vehicles is absolutely amazing. And the way it was produced was just really interesting to follow and learn more about the drivers and the crews and the managers. And it's a whole industry that I had never, ever, I mean, I've never, ever had any exposure to. So that was super interesting. And I think that there's actually, I am watching a show right now, always recommended to me. I'm only in the first two parts of it, called The OA. I don't know if you're familiar with
that. I saw the ad for it, and I have not watched it yet.
So I can't tell where it's going. It's a little bit fantasy, mystery. We'll see what happens. I don't know.
It just recently came out. All right.
We're in season, I think it's in season two.
Oh, is it already?
Yeah, okay. But
I just found out about it now.
Just started that one, so that looks, the first two parts have been interesting, and it's sucking me in to continue to keep watching, so that's good.
Good. Cool. All right. So back to design. So you found out about graphic design, started finding out about the whole universe of branding. And then how did that translate into starting out as a career? How did you find your job?
Yeah. So interestingly enough, my first job was in a consumer packaged goods agency in Chicago, which no longer exists, and started working in CPG right away. And I would say that first
That's
your
consumer packaged goods.
Consumer packaged goods, right.
So most of the stuff you buy in a supermarket, that's...
Sorry about the acronyms.
That's fine.
It's just second speak now.
No, no, not everybody knows about... So we just want to make sure that we're just pulling some stuff out and laying it out for people who don't work in this industry.
No problem. So I started working in food and sports and hardware. Again, multiple different channels for what we were doing, and did that for a number of years.
So when we say channels, so like the packaging might be one?
So when I say channels, I mean when you say health and beauty,
okay.
sports and entertainment,
okay.
automotive, food, beverage,
okay,
spirits.
I was thinking
beer.
Media channels.
There's also, you can think about channels in terms of C-store, grocery. There's okay. different, it can be used.
Right.
A number of different ways, but have had experience in all of the channels, both retail channels and different categories. So the different categories and really looking at brands in different categories. And a lot of that the first 2 years of working in the industry was like learning another language, really learning about marketing, really trying to understand what drives and motivates people and really helping really think about what are we doing? Like, what's the purpose of what we're doing with brands? And as that developed and I started thinking about that, really started to think about how psychology is related to brands. And there's a lot of methodologies and processes that are adapted from psychology to help us understand how we think about brands in a more soulful way. So
is there an example that you might have or that you remember?
So a couple examples would Maslow's hierarchy of needs has been used in marketing for a number of years. There are different psychologists. Dr. Gloria Wilcox has created an emotion wheel. And on that emotion wheel can help us determine what are those emotional reasons to believe.
So this is in the process of, say, you're creating a new brand?
You can be repositioning a brand. You can be defining a brand.
Okay.
You can be dusting off a brand to figure out what is it, what really is our purpose. There are core questions, I think, that with brand stewardship, you have to keep asking yourself and the team to keep it fresh, to keep it relevant. I think you run the risk without brand stewardship of becoming stale and passed up in a marketplace where people are not as brand loyal as they used to be just because of the amount of options as we have. So unless you're serving a need and doing a job for someone, and you really have a unique point of difference, it's really hard to compete.
Right. So there's a couple of things, at least a couple of things I'm thinking out of that, but just one thing to make sure I understand, because I think I understand, but and also for everybody listening, when you say brand stewardship, that sounds like the responsibility of making sure that the purpose that was created, whenever that was done, is still being followed and Whose job is brand stewardship?
Brand stewardship, we think of ourselves as an agency as being a brand steward,
okay.
but the brand stewardship is a team sport. So your brand marketers, your marketing team, I would say your cross-functional agency teams. We don't work enough with cross-functional teams to really understand the real team that needs to happen.
Cross-functional on the client side as well?
Client side as well.
Right.
So working with consumer insights, working with the sales team.
With the product team, with the... Okay.
Absolutely. Like there is, it's a team sport, definitely, when it comes to really thinking about your brand and holistically thinking about your brand. One thing we talk about with SoulSight is we really drive a holistic methodology. You getting the right players at the table to discuss these things are crucial to making sure that everything is activating with purpose together, not in separate components for different reasons. Yeah, I know you have an advertising background, but when you think about advertising and media, sometimes it serves the purpose of awareness. It always serves the purpose of awareness, actually. And what does that mean for the long term? And how is the media campaign giving back to the brand purpose? And how is the brand purpose giving to the media program? They need to coexist together as in a relationship, not separate, where you sometimes can see that balance spin out of control and then things become irrelevant for how it really is relatable or why it's relatable to who you're trying to connect with.
Right.
I think as we have tried to dig into really understanding what that empathetic lens is for us as a brand steward is really driving getting out of our bubble and really observing people again. You know, it goes back to some of the interests that I've had, but how to get out and observe people, go and do ethnographies, go into their homes, understand them. You know, it's like we live in a city here in Chicago, but you go, you drive an hour to the west or an hour to the south, the culture is very different. And most of America is very different than these urban areas that we surround ourselves with. Yeah. So it's really important to get out and really understand who is using our products and who's using our brands and what's that journey that that brand goes through. We say this journey of understanding the brand is so much important of what is the brand on the shelf? Now, though, what's the brand in your hand? What's the brand in digitally in your hand? What's the brand in your home? What's the brand in your life? And then what's the brand in this universe? You know, like, what does that mean for us? And my wife will give me crap every once in a while talking about, you know, well, you work in marketing. You know, sometimes you feel like that is you're selling people things that they don't really need. And, you know, my reaction to that is really the brands that we create and the products that we create are really, they define who we are as a culture today. I mean, if we were to go and dig up what life was like 50 years ago or 100 years ago, what do you look at? People's trash. You look at the objects they were using to cook with or clean with. What we're doing today is really defining the needs and the values and the purpose of and the ethics of what our culture is defined as. And you'll see different pockets of what that might look like in different areas of the country, but or countries and world. But it's really interesting when you think about it from that perspective. I like to say that even a brand is an artifact of a moment of time. And some brands that can last 100 years or 200 years, but they also evolve to stay relevant.
Yeah, they do. Wow, this is fascinating. This is great. And even more it's making me think of. But I'm going to go backtrack to one of the points you made earlier. And this is an ongoing conversation. It's not a new conversation, but the point about a brand needs to be distinctive and needs to be, there's a point of difference. And there's been a lot of conversation for a while, and even more so now, for a while, one about, is it all that important, particularly because supermarkets are in store brands and white label brands are, like, fulfill the same function as many others that might be branded. That's been ongoing for a while. And then there's a more recent conversation that with voice-activated devices, so like an Amazon Echo, Alexa. And if you ask Alexa, like, you know, refill my toilet paper, does it really matter? Or unless you already have a brand that your name has replaced the whole category, like, you know, order me some Kleenex.
Exactly.
So I don't know, what's your view on like, what's the space for distinctiveness for a brand today?
Well, I think it's easier for a brand to become a commodity. That's, you know, it's a bad word, you know, when you think of water. You have a bottle of Fiji water sitting in front of you. That water could easily be in a glass and taste just as great as in that bottle. But all of a sudden, when it's wrapped in something that has purpose or meaning or authenticity of where it's coming from, it's no longer a commodity. It becomes something a little bit more special. So I think where you run the risk of commodity-driven products are products that are in the market but they're not gone through the lens of really thinking about what's authentic to them, like what's unique and different, and asking those hard questions, like, well, are we doing something different? If we're just putting something on shelf to compete versus really be differentiated and have something and offer something different, then we truly are creating something unique and ownable. But if you're just creating something to compete with Fiji, you're not only making yourself a commodity, but you're making those brands that you're competing against a commodity. So I think in a market where I think we're kind of on the cusp of coming down from this market that we've driven with, 60,000 brands can exist in one grocery store. I don't know what that, there's a statistic that's just crazy now. So think about that from a consumer standpoint. So like, there's so many products from a private label that are competing with national brands. Some private labels done a great job of telling authentic stories, which feel that they're coming more from the grocer or more from, they're coming from more of a local. Trader Joe's has done a great job of creating this.
Out of the UK, the John Lewis Christmas ads.
Right. Their perception of it feeling like it is more human. Mm-hmm. You know, so how do we make brands more human in that way so that they're not commodities or that they're more ownable in a way that makes me want to use it as a badge to serve for myself? And I think that it's a great question to ask ourselves as with existing brands that are in the market and brands that we're in constantly innovating with. I'm not sure if that totally answers your question.
No, it does. And I was going to dig in on one thing because I know those conversations happen and there's a lot of people listening that deal with the difficulties of having those conversations with clients. So say, you know, one brand that might be saying, like, I actually really need to create this product because I need to compete with this competitor that has created this product. And it seems like a knee-jerk reaction. How do you, or is there anything that you found successful in navigating those kind of occasionally delicate conversations to say, okay, are we really either fulfilling on a need or an opportunity or a challenge that people have? Or are we creating something that's really distinctive and challenging? Like, is there anything that you do that you found that works in the process of having those kind of complicated or diplomatic conversations with a client to try to say, okay, well, I think we should go in this direction for this particular brand? You might have a point of view or not. And I don't know. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, it does make sense. I think, so like, there's a tool that we use, and good or bad, it's still subjective, right? I think qualitative research for us, and especially with larger brands or actually an innovation, of really understanding and seeding, and it's rapid ideation and rapid qualitative groups where we're really listening. I think you really have to be open to listening. And I think the advice is listen to understand what your target is telling you about this opportunity or your brand. So many times I think that, again, we get stuck in a bubble where we think, we have all these brand assets and these are our distinct brand assets and we can't walk away from them. But are your consumers or the people who are purchasing your product recalling those same assets? And are they telling you, can they tell you what you mean? Like, can you tell me what your brand means or what you stand for? And asking those questions in not in an attacking way, but in a way to really help them think about it. And I think in a number of times we do a lot of stakeholder interviews where we talk to, and I say stakeholders, it doesn't just mean the CMOs and the CEOs or the brand directors or the marketing directors, but also in the individuals who are maybe the influencers or the targets of the people that we're targeting, and understanding the complete picture of their perspective on what brands mean, what are you looking for. There's a question that we ask when we initiate a project is, if you could create a legacy, you're not going to work on this. Most of these marketers aren't going to work on these brands for the rest of their lives. So what legacy would you like to leave this brand for the next team that touches it? And that question often provokes a deeper seated level of purpose, not only for the brand, but for them, because everyone that touches that brand is part of that brand, from the person on the line in the factory to the sales guy who's delivering it to the store, to the designer here at SoulSight that's developing the icons or marks or brands that are on whatever touch point for the brand that we're creating. So it becomes more personal then. So taking the brand and making it more soulful and purposeful helps that discussion. Again, it is still subjective, but it's really important to have almost a therapy session on what does this brand, like, what do we really want from this brand? And I think when we talk about measurement and what does success look like, it has to be both qualitative and quantitative. I think you need it to be quantitative because you need to sell it in the market and you need the statistics to go in and prove that something is going to sell or not sell, or where the opportunity is and how many shares are we going after, or where does it going to fit? Who is it going to compete against? But the qualitative is equally important to understand, going back to what's our purpose, what's our story, and making sure that the team is equipped with those tools to go in and talk about the brand in that way.
That's great. Thank you. And you've mentioned a couple of things, which is perfect, because I was thinking about digging that particular point as well, which is on taking time and making sure you take time and we take time to go out there and go and like talk to people and understand and look at them and understand how people are using the products or the everyday stuff that we're talking about. And that's something that I've found to be a challenge for a lot of my peers on the advertising and marketing side of things. So strategists or even designers, creative, like people who are involved in this type of work and on the branding side as well. The more it goes, the busier you are, the more we become like just rely on like looking at stuff on the internet and looking at stuff on Google rather than going outside. Also because we run out of time, to be honest.
Yes.
So I was wondering, how do you at SoulSight or in your experience keep a view on just making sure you take time to go out there, like literally outside?
Yeah, I mean, it becomes part of our process where we actually do some auditing. So depending on what market we're in, if say we were working on a gym, you know, gym branding, we're going to brand the next Orange Theory. Uh-huh. You know, we make sure that we go out and we experience what are those, what is it like? We talk to individuals that are using those gyms and are in those environments, and what are the things that are working for them? What are the things that are not working for them? What things would they like to see different? But we experience them ourselves. You know, we take the time to sit and brief and talk about what is the experience of that brand. A brand is more than just the logo, but that experience that happens within the people that are in there and surrounding themselves and participating in being able to have those conversations immerses you in a different headspace, I think, than just thinking about what that means in a office environment.
Yeah.
And bringing some of the, we also do a lot of, when we talk about auditing a brand, is more than just about what does it look like as it appears in the marketplace, but how are we, what's the tone of voice? How are they speaking? And it's interesting that you start to find there's sometimes 7 or 8 different voices that when you actually pull it all together, there's a way to simply clean up the communication to make sure that the interaction feels consistent. And being able to present that back to a marketing team and say, wow, like I didn't realize even from a visual perspective, we're coming off in a very different way than we are in a billboard or on a package or whatever the application or touch point might be, or how we're coming across in PR or radio. So it's very important to start thinking about how we're holistically looking at how we're auditing those things.
And is there an average time that this research phase might take in a general process that you go through?
It would depend, I think, on the assignment. So
let's say for a new brand or a rebrand.
In a perfect world, in an idealistic world. In an idealistic world, we'd love to take 4 or 5 weeks to really dig in and do this work. Sometimes we're doing it in 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Sometimes we're doing it in 5 days. You know, it depends on the opportunity and what we're willing to look at or what we really need to learn. It's interesting, too, when you start tapping into the talent that we have here at SoulSight. There's so many people that have different life experiences or different interests that we start to find influencers and experts in different markets or fields or branding places where the person that could be sitting right next to you sometimes that is a wealth of knowledge.
Yeah.
We tap into a lot of secondary research, too. So using the Mentels of the world or iconoculture or different ways to understand what's happening from a trend perspective. What's interesting about a lot of that data, though, is a lot of that is historic of what's already happened. And a lot of the work that we're doing is, which is great to understand as a baseline, but what's next? Mm-hmm. You know, and understanding what's next and helping being a trendsetter for what's next or developing what that next big opportunity is the exciting part. No one can really answer that question for you. You have to build it.
Yeah. Well, actually, there's one thing I wanted to touch upon, which is great and it might be related to what's next. And to the bottle of water that you described earlier, and I saw that the Big Book of Packaging, you have about a third of the packagings that are either green or recycled, and you know there's increasing amounts of pushback to having bottled water. There's a lot more people that have plastic. So I was wondering the space of or the kinds of conversations or trends that are going on that you're experiencing around either recycling, sustainability. Doing things with a bit more regard for the environment or greener, quote unquote. I don't know if that's the right word anymore because I don't mean greenwashing.
Not greenwashing, but, right.
So, yeah, how is that coming across? Are more clients interested? Is this something you're
It is. I think from most of the clients that we work with have initiatives to sustainability initiatives, and they're always looking at ways to think about scalability is always going to be an issue, and how do you scale and how do you get to market quickly? How do you make sure that you're able to produce something in a way that that's not going to take more time for the consumers to get to or engage with? So there is constantly an effort to think about reduction of plastic. How do we think about more recyclable materials? Or if you do need to resort in some sort of plastic, is it something that has the technology to decompose much quicker than a traditional plastic bottle that was made in the 80s, and you hear the stories about plastic bags washing up in the ocean that are 20 or 30 years old that you can still read the graphics. You know, it's scary. I mean, it's a very scary story to tell. And I don't think my first real, what's the right way to say it? My first real time seeing it live was my family was vacationing in the Dominican Republic, and we were driving away from the resort, and it had been raining for 3 days straight. And I saw the way that the garbage was being tossed next to a river, and the amount of plastic and the amount of bottles that were just running into the river and out into the sea made me really think about what that does in a smaller country like the Dominican Republic. But can you imagine the scale of what that means in a country like the U.S. and how we're thinking about those things? I think recycling programs can only do a part of the job. I think the responsibility lies on the manufacturers and the corporations that are producing. And I think there are efforts. And from a design perspective, we're always trying to provide solutions that help engage. Again, it becomes a cost issue a lot on what and scale issue on changing out old equipment and the cost of investment and what that means moving forward. But it is definitely always top of mind in a lot of the work that we do.
Interesting. Thanks. Another thing I was thinking about in terms of packaging was, so you work you work with a lot of very large brands.
Mm-hmm.
And some of those large brands are being now competed with by smaller upcoming markets directing. So typically or often, they're selling directly off of their website. And so that might be Glossier, for example, is one of a beauty products brand out of New York is one thing I'm thinking about. And I know a lot of others. I have a friend of mine who has a small business. He does phone cases.
Mm-hmm.
But he does the same kind of thing, which is that those brands have very beautiful packaging, or arguably, but typically they do. So you receive it in the mail. They almost have, they're designed in a way that you want to take a photo and post it on Instagram.
Exactly.
Right? I don't know if you've come across examples of those types of brands that were particularly, interesting from a packaging or design perspective, or how this trend is impacting some of the work that you're doing.
Well, it's interesting too, because we've talked about this before. It's like traditional retail shopping is changing, then the brand, you have more control of your brand experience.
True.
So how that package arrives to the consumer, you're able to tell the narrative. So some of those examples that you're talking about, I remember Harry's Shave Club. That experience of receiving that product, it's a beautifully designed razor, and then all the components with it, the stories that the different aftershaves tell, that experience wants you to be part of that club. You know, and how do you become, you create an engaged consumer that continues to be interested in receiving those types of things. I think we've seen it a lot too with mail order. The flowers is a mail order service now. A lot of flowers are ordered online and delivered. And a few years ago, we had the opportunity to rebrand and rethink what does that delivery experience look like for FTD, and thinking about what does the outer FTD. It's a floral company that's been around for probably about 100 years. And they're global. They're called Inner Floral
UK. Okay.
So it's all online ordering. But when you receive the box that they were delivering was a typical brown box. But how do we create an experience that when you see it on the UPS cart or the FedEx cart, it looks like something interesting? And when it arrives at your desk, what's the experience of opening that box and the experience of what is that saying about the brand, so that it feels more special, so that the box can feel part of the experience, not just the flower. Yeah. So you're telling a story for the brand that creates this, what we call the messenger of love, which is the Mercury Man, which is used as a symbol for the brand. So those are just a couple of examples, but there's many, many, many more that, you know, I'm seeing when I've ordered shoes in the mail, and the type of how that is delivered and unpacked. I ordered a Tufted Needle mattress, and how the experience of how that comes apart and unrolls, and then you watch the mattress expand as it fills your bed frame. It's magical.
Yeah, I've heard that I've not seen it, but I listen to some of the podcasts I listen to, then there's several brand of those mattresses that advertise on podcasts. I remember on the Marc Maron podcast, WTF, which is a big interview podcast, his whole ad is he's describing exactly what you just did. He was like, it's amazing when he opens up. And
yeah, you're creating an experience that is memorable. And
yeah.
You can't, that's gold.
Yeah. Cool. Thank you. So, all your career, and you're still in design, but your title now is Chief Strategy Officer. Was there a moment where your responsibilities shifted and your title shifted, or?
Well, as we were growing our agency, Adam Ferguson, and George Argyros, who are both my business partners, we all have background in design.
Yeah.
And as we grew, as we were continuing to grow, you know, I played the role of a creative director when we were smaller, but really seeing the need to push into different areas. And one need that we saw was thinking about strategy. And I often believe that designers are amazing strategists, and you have to be thinking like a strategist in order to do compelling design that connects. And really just started to do a bunch of research and really trying to understand from at a smaller agency level, what does that mean for us? And what does that mean for, how does this help build better creative? And what does that mean for helping work with my partner who's a creative, two partners who are a creative, and what does that mean for our organization? So what we've done for SoulSight, I think, is different than a traditional planning role, because it is really interconnected between the business strategy, the brand strategy, and then the design strategy are all merged into this triangle where the teams come together to really decide how we're working together. Again, a diverse way to think about things. And when I say a creative strategist, it's almost using the middle brain to think about how we develop products and solutions and ideas, and driving not just the business forward and how we think about what categories are we going after, but the brands that we're honored to work on, how do we think about pushing them forward? So we're constantly thinking about what's the pipeline of opportunity, how do things move forward? And my role as a creative, it was a little bittersweet, because I do love creating. I'm a maker, you know, I love to make things. But being able to move into an area where I can still be a maker, but through the lens of strategy and interpreting something that's intangible to make it tangible, whether it's through words or visuals or inspiration or storytelling, and then see it come to life in even a more tangible way, visualized with a creative team, that's magical, you know, and it's the secret sauce that you can't really describe, but how that gets interpreted. So being one of our mission is really to be a guide for our clients in that way. And being a guide for our agency in that way is really rewarding, to see things come to light. I get the nickname Hurricane Jim, and I don't know why. I think I'm pretty approachable, but
that's an awesome nickname.
Sometimes they'll say, you know, you can come in the room and stir things up, and I'll ask, and the team will say, but it's a good hurricane. It's not a bad hurricane. It's like, we want, you know, designers love to be challenged. They love to be they love to be problem solved. The worst thing they can do is put something on the wall and you say, it's great just as it is. You know, and that's something that we're always conscious of, is like, nothing, at some point you have to say, yeah, put the pencils down, let's present this and put it to the client. But a designer's work is never done. We're constantly evolving. We need to constantly be learning. We need to be constantly on the edge of what is happening in the world. It's just, you need to be able to be putting yourself out there and taking risks in order to continue to be a healthy environment. I think we are only at SoulSight, we're only as good as the people that we surround ourselves with here. So we're privileged to work with amazing talent. And I think some of the things that we're doing to push ourselves a little bit more is to push ourselves into more of a sports and entertainment world, and become thinking about how this holistic consumer viewpoint that we have, how do we translate that into lifestyle and sports and entertainment. The connection of what we're doing with branding, from what we found, hasn't in the CPG world, hasn't really been yet applied to that world or that market in the same way as, and the vigor of where our background comes from. So we're working hard to work on opportunities with different organizations, entertainment and sports and companies, to get to a point where we're constantly evolving and thinking about all this great knowledge that we have about human beings and brands, and what that can mean moving forward for us as an agency.
Fantastic. All right. Just conscious of time, I think we're going to start wrapping up. And By the way, it's awesome. Sorry, I don't know. So, sometimes I am self-conscious about my own transitions.
Oh, don't worry about it.
No, this is perfect. It's great. And it's great to hear like everything that's going on and where you're going next with SoulSight. I usually finish with those cool-down questions because it's the Ice Cream for Everyone podcast. And so the easy one to start with is, do you have a favorite ice cream flavor?
I am a vanilla bean guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sounds boring, but I'm a vanilla bean.
I am a little bit like that. I have other flavors too, but if I'm not sure this is a new ice cream parlor I'm trying, I will taste the vanilla. And if the vanilla is really good, I'll either have it or I'll know. Or sometimes if it's not good, then I might not have ice cream at all.
Right.
Is there a game that you enjoy and recommend playing?
A game?
Anything with your children or not, you know.
Well, that's a great question. I don't know that I'm not a big, it's funny you're asking me this question because my wife loves to play games with the kids. And I'm trying to learn Euchre right now.
I've heard about it. I know it's quite
a card game. Yeah, so I'm trying to learn Euchre. It's a little bit difficult. And I would say that I would recommend, it's a good game to play because you play in teams and it's a good family game. So I'm trying to learn, I would say if I could recommend anything, it would be Euchre. I'm not a big game person or a big gamer.
No problem. What's the last piece of art or media that had an impact on you?
Art or media? I would say that there was... This is going to sound really... This is going to sound really kind of corny, but I just watched the new Mary Poppins movie at home with the kids. And if they talk about media, and was really... fascinated by some of the cinematography in that, and growing up watching the original Mary Poppins and then seeing this come to life with my kids and through my kids' eyes, and the magic that has happened with that was a pretty inspiring time with my kids.
They enjoy it then?
Yes, my kids enjoyed it. I enjoyed it. I still think I prefer
I'm the same. I saw the new one recently. I just saw it on the TV as well. I just saw it like a couple of weeks ago. I enjoyed it, but yeah, I prefer the original because it's they did a great job, but they did a great job at more or less kind of repeating the same thing.
Exactly. Which, yeah. So, you know, that's always inspiring. I'm trying to think from a piece of art. It's so diverse. That's a really hard. That's a hard thing to answer.
My Poppins is totally fine. It's a perfectly valid answer.
Yeah. I like the notion and symbology of Mary Poppins. I guess too. It's funny we watched Mary Poppins, and then on Netflix you can watch the Dick Van Dyke Show. So in the last 2 weeks, my kids are on spring break this week, we've been every night watching a couple episodes of the Dick Van Dyke Show, and that's been kind of fun, just as an entertainer and a physical entertainer that he is, it's interesting to introduce my children to things that even happened before my time.
Yeah, it's great. It's great. There's some stuff that are still holding together. What's something you think everyone should experience at least once?
Oh, man, you asked some good questions. I would say if they should be able to experience, I would say, is it weird to say like meditation, like, or... really a level of calm.
Do you meditate? Like,
I do.
Yeah.
And it's changed my perspective, and it's cleared my head in ways that I never thought was possible.
Yeah, me too. And I've been meditating for now 3 years-ish?
Yeah.
So what's your practice, if I may ask?
I've tried everything from transcendental meditation to guided meditation through different types of recordings. Not really phone apps, but more guided meditations, almost like a CD so that you can listen to. Or no, they're not, no one listens to CDs anymore, but MP, what would you call that? Like a podcast or a...
A music file.
Yeah, music file, I guess. I don't know what the right terminology is.
Audio file,
yeah. There are, I think that is something that is pretty cool. I think... If you can, anyone that can experience time away, unconnected, is priceless, especially with people that you love around you.
Yeah. Fantastic. I know it's made a huge difference for me to be, I've always been interested in personal growth and development. I've not done tons of different things. So like I used to work for Landmark, and I've done their course, quite a few of their courses. And I've been meditating also for the past three-ish, 4 years. I was doing 10, I've never done very long sessions. I was doing 20 minutes a day. I did a little bit, 10 minutes like guided. I tried different apps, some voices I didn't really like. And so I just shifted a few. Then for a bit, for a while, I was doing 20 minutes a day unguided. And then there's Sam Harris that I quite like and listen to his podcast, who's a bit of a controversial figure in some ways, but interested in spirituality and released a new app that I really like. And so I've been doing his guided meditations at the moment, just 10 minutes a day.
Yeah, I mean, they do help with clarity. They help with your mental well-being, your perspective.
It's
helped me with a lot. It just it helps clear your mind between sometimes even if it can be a short 5 minute meditation between meetings sometimes. You know, one important principle that we live by in my team, if they ever listen to this will laugh, is I think you're responsible for the energy that you bring to a room and the energy that you bring to a conversation. And we all own that, and we need to be conscious of that when we're engaging with individuals.
Yeah.
We are a service company too, so like some of that is also like the energy that you bring is a reflection on who we are as an agency and who what our brand is also. But it's not just about your personal brand. There's an agency brand, but that energy, internally and externally, people feel it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, perfect. This is a great place to complete the conversation, I think. So if anybody's looking for you, they can look up SoulSight. Is there anywhere else online they can look you up?
SoulSight.com. We're on Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn. You can find us everywhere.
Perfect. Thank you very much, Jim. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
All right, another episode wrapping up. Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate you listening. Makes a hell of a difference. As I said at the beginning, if you enjoyed the episode, please share it with friends. I'm just doing this so that more people get to listen to it and more people get to learn about both branding, marketing, advertising, game design, playful experiences. If you're one of the gamers that enjoy the advertising-focused or branding-focused episodes, please tell me. I'd love to hear from you. And the other way around, if you're somebody who works in creative communications, branding, advertising, design, and you enjoy my conversations rambling about role-playing games or game design, please tell me that too. I've heard some feedback from that point of view, certainly. So, I mean, I always like to have some more. So that's about it for now. Please have a fantastic evening, morning, afternoon, night or day, whatever time of day or night it is for you. And I'll see you later. Bye.